Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 4,282 of the Bugle audio newspaper for a visual universe. Only kidding, visual world. Still no conclusive evidence that the universe exists for me, but the world, I'm on it right now, and it doesn't get any more real than that. I am Andy Zaltzman, still, and if I could turn back time, well, I wouldn't be doing this podcast for a whole host of reasons. If you're listening to this through a smart speaker, just see what happens when this bit plays out. Hey, whatever your smart speaker's current name is, do an impression of Andy Zaltzman, Alice Fraser and Mark Steele talking about the world's news. And now see if you can tell the difference from what the rest of the show. Welcome to the show. So, yes, there you are, our guest today, Alice Fraser in Sydney, New South Wales, about to move to Queensland. When are they going to update that name? It just seems a bit insensitive now. Queensland.
Yes, but that is Queensland's calling card is being insensitive, so I figure they're just going to lean in.
Mark Steele joining us from Crystal Palace, correct?
I'm in North London at the moment for a series of reasons.
Right. Well, Crystal Palace is another place that really needs to update its name. The thing burnt down in 1936. it's like calling Pompeii never been inconvenienced by a volcanic eruption. So how are you?
They say those in Crystal Palaces shouldn't throw incendiary devices.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, that's what started that particular phrase. If only that phrase had existed in 1936, but someone said, I don't see the problem. Oh, no, what have you done?
How are you, Mark?
Well, cancer, but apart from that, I'm all right.
All right. that's a very direct way of breaking it to any Bugle listeners who've not heard that news. You have written about it and talked about it on your own shows.
Yeah. I've got cheery at the moment because the sort of the bad thing that happened about 6 weeks ago, I'm recovered from that. And then all this treatment starts next week. So at the moment, I'm in this sort of little pocket of cheeriness where I'm quite feel fine, and the slightest little thing gives me immense joy. Like all the window cleaners around, I mean, what's paying? This is the sort of thing that makes life worth living. Look at the cat doing a shit.
Life goes on.
It's amazing. Well, I recommend it. It's great cancer because it's sort of, you think, oh god, and I'm. And then I had one day that was really grim. One of this consultant who probably wasn't going to win any awards for communication skills said, this is exact words, not good news, Mr. Steele. And he said, and that's what I knew for certain. He said, oh, you've got cancer and this is secondary cancer, used in two places. And I said, is it fatal? And he went, touch wood, and then touched a bit of wood.
Oh, no.
I thought, oh, well, at least if he hadn't touched any wood, that would have been even more disturbing, I suppose. It's not even worth attempting a superstitious remedy. But anyway, it's not. It's going to be all right. Do you touch wood in Australia for luck? I don't know, this might be an English thing, I don't know.
No, we touch wood. We've got wood, we touch it.
But you've got to do it the other way.
Wood, and that means lucky, you know, let's hope. And then maybe that's what did it, because the next day I found out that it, you know, the cancer had spread anywhere, and therefore it's what seems to be fairly pretty much certain that they'll deal with it. But, you know, and maybe the reason that they'll be able to deal with it is because he touched wood, and whatever spirits and fairies are sort of informed at that point, they noted it down.
I think that's the kind of level of science that we've been hearing about here in the COVID inquiry, which we'll be talking about later. Well, great, it's great to have you on the show, Alice. You are now approximately what is it? It's over 75% pregnant now. And
yes, almost completely pregnant.
I like to see these things in statistical terms.
I've almost achieved my final form of being entirely spherical. Touch wood.
That's exciting, though.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's a delight in every possible way, particularly having a toddler means that I get to have the joy of being kicked from both the outside and the inside at the same time, which is novel.
Yeah. I was asked in one of the meetings where they were talking about radiotherapy and they go through all these side effects, the way she put it, her English wasn't perfect, this assault. She said, "I must ask you, have you completed your family?" What? What do you mean? And I thought, well, it's a jigsaw. And she said, "No, have you completed your family?" I said, "I don't know what you mean." She said, "Well, have you?" And then I realised what she meant. And then I realised, A, what she meant, and B, that apparently this radiotherapy, if I hadn't completed my family, was going to significantly impair my ability to make any more family.
We are recording on the 24th of November, 2023. Just a couple of days ago, it was 60 years since John F. Kennedy was assassinated by... I've got the envelope here, courtesy of a friend who works in the highest levels of American intelligence. Interesting. Very interesting. On the same day, the 22nd of November 1963, current Sunderland football manager Tony Mowbray was born. Yes, the former Middlesbrough centre-back came into the world at the exact same moment that John F. Kennedy left it. Read into that what you will. Also, at 9 and a bit months, about 40 weeks later, Keanu Reeves was born. Read into that what you will. Also popping their clogs on the 22nd of November 1963, two giants of English literature, the wardrobe fetishist C.S. Lewis and dystopia aficionado Aldous Huxley, which has to be disappointing if you're dying thinking, well, I'm quite a literature celebrity, I'm going to be absolutely front page news. Who's been shot? What a disappointing way to go. As always, a section of the Bugle is going straight in the bin. This week, we look at the words of the year. Last year, the Cambridge Dictionary chose hallucinate as the word of the year. The word-nerding, book-bothering boffins chose hallucinate after it impressively branched out into new meanings, specifically describing how AI generates text. It hallucinates text. So that was their word of the year. It's not the first person to hallucinate text. Yeah.
I didn't see that.
All right.
It's just a hallucination joke there for you all.
Not the first person to hallucinate text, to be honest. Also describes how former Home Secretary Suella Braverman acquires evidence before making policies. So hallucinate is qualified as British Word of the Year for the European Word of the Year contest, where it'll be up against the continent's best verbal offerings, including flaguette from France, which is a slightly past its best baguette. The words hotly tipped to challenge for the Word of the Year in 2024 include draculate, which in economics is a company that sucks the blood out of defenceless competitors without really making its own life any better. So that's most companies over a certain size. Phanesthesia, which is being put to sleep by people complaining about refereeing decisions on a football phone-in. Yesimism, which is doing something that you think you should do, even though you know it will have absolutely all impacts whatsoever. For example, recycling a tin can, signing a petition to demand more ethical oil exploration practices by global oil giants in developing countries, that kind of thing. Swearobics, obviously, it's got to be Jewish term. Obfs, but spelt with an F, not a V, that's short for obfuscation, given that we have both elections coming in both the UK and the US. Oppenheimlich, which is to save something at the last moment, only to unleash something far, far worse. I like that one. Mapologise, that's his belated post-imperial acceptance that changing the names of places and drawing borders randomly on maps doesn't always turn out tremendously well. Musicalatable, which is something that can be turned into a musical, which is apparently every single f***ing thing that has ever existed. That section in the bin. Top story this week, war is over. For a little bit. 4 days precisely. Don't worry, human suffering fans. War will once again not be over in just 4 days' time. Today, as we recorded, is day one of a four-day ceasefire. Did we ever finalise the language on? Is it a pause, a ceasefire, a pause fire, a ceastrosity, or a T interval? T short for temporary break in hostilities. We'll let history be the judge of that. It's the last couple of months, ever since Hamas perpetrated its terrorist abominations, have been an even more difficult time than usual to be on the I wish people would stop killing each other and learn to live in harmony, even whilst I also acknowledge how difficult that may be to achieve politically, end of the political seesaw when it comes to the Middle East. Mark, you've not been on the Bugle since the start of this latest flare-up in this, crisis that began pretty much after God span his globe and said, yep, that bit. Is there any optimism from the fact that there is at least this little micro glimmer of light?
No, I'm not all that optimistic. I think you're quite right. It is probably more like a T interval, and then they'll ring a bell when it's 5 minutes from the end, and then they'll go back to the commentary. Oh, they're coming out again. Here come all the drones, and there's the Israeli Defence Force. Yeah, there is some optimism. The amazing thing about this, in the first few days after it happened, it just seemed that if you were of the view that slaughtering civilians who had gone to a music festival was horrible and bombing hospitals was also horrible, that was an extremist point of view. Most people in the world, I mean, something like 76% of people in Britain think that a ceasefire is think that they ought to stop killing each other. Sort of optimistic that only 24% of the British population think, no, I'm enjoying you slaughtering children. That's quite chirpy, isn't it?
I guess so.
The exchange of not enough hostages for not enough ceasefire is simultaneously a very impressive bit of international diplomatic relations and depressingly inadequate given the sort of five-dimensional depth of the conflict that is going on in that area, which is to say there are these like irreconcilable differences about things like whose house this is that stretch across geography, time, and apparently into consensus reality. But I find the ceasefire itself sort of depressing because it just means that you could not, you know?
Yes, like, yeah.
What if we just didn't? Turns out to be an option. Whereas, you know, you're sort of faced with this horrible conflict and you feel so helpless to it that it could ever possibly be wound up in any way that would make anybody happy. And then they're just like, oh, we can stop for 4 days.
Yeah, it's like the famous Christmas Day football match in the First World War, the first Christmas of the First World War, 1914. There was a ceasefire for Christmas Day. They played football. There was a controversial offside decision, and it took 4 more years of fighting before everyone calmed down. But that's football, I think, more than anything.
VAR have only just come up with a decision, in fact.
For those of you who are not aware of it, the Middle East, or as I assume it's known, Alice, if you live in Australia, the Middle Northwest, is, of course, the old stomping ground of biblical super celebs such as slow travel pioneer Moses, magician, raconteur and escapologist Jesus Christ, former MMA star Goliath and token romantic interest Mary. And like I said, I find it hard to be optimistic because we're conditioned from childhood to want stories to have happy endings. That's why we don't have children's books like The Lion, the Witch and the Dunking Pond, The Typhoid Who Came to Tea, The Very Hungry Cannibal, The Snuffalo, Marjorie Taylor Greene and the Chocolate Factory, 14 Remaining Dalmatians. You've got to gently introduce children to the concept of mortality, but it has to be handled a bit more sensitively. And Winnie the Putin. But we don't have books like that because we search for happy narratives. But reality seldom provides the kind of endings that we're taught to want from childhood. And I guess the best we can hope for in the Middle East is, and they all lived happily ever after for a maximum of 96 hours.
Is Winnie the Putin, like, instead of not wearing pants, he just doesn't wear a shirt?
Yes.
COVID inquiry news now. Well, here in the United Kingdom, we have, for some weeks now, been enjoying, is that the right term? No. The official inquiry into how the government dealt with COVID. Mark, as a long-time supporter of the Conservative Party and dyed-in-the-woolen blazer adherent of Thatcherite social and economic policy, it must have been very hard for you to watch your heroes turn out not to have just have feet of clay, but to have feet of clumsily modelled, incompetently fired, probably corrupt, shit-covered clay. How have you dealt with
Much of the British sort of news channels have been saying things during the COVID inquiry, such as, it's just extraordinary. The revelations have been quite remarkable, despite the fact that all through the lockdown, everyone was going, I haven't got a f***ing clue. And they were just sort of, Boris Johnson would be at the time coming on television every day saying, the R rate, if it exceeds, it's gone down from 3 to 9, which shows that it's, you must go to work, but are not permitted to travel there, and you must fly, but not within 6 feet of birds, and the maximum number permitted in a room is not. So if you find yourself in a room, you must leave immediately. Only 2 people are permitted in any degree of latitude. So before you go to the kitchen, you must check with Morocco. And anybody could have said, right, this is just, I haven't got a clue. And Matt Hancock, who used to stand there every day, I felt sorry for him, in front of the scientists, and he'd be asked a question like, do you think that the new variant has maybe a capacity, biologically speaking, to invade other parts of the anatomy? And Matt Hancock would stand there like I would be if I suddenly got a job in a cutting quick fit, and someone was going, what's the PR312 setting on this carburetor? And I'd just be stood there going, is it the purple one? And so then he off to Australia to earn £400,000 on Almost Celebrity, which I think from the start would have been all right if Ant and Dec every night had gone, just as he was about to put his head in a box of scorpions. Normally we would give you goggles for this, Mark, but I'm afraid we've run out of protective equipment. And all of them were passing off the PPE contract for billions of pounds to people who live next door and their aunt and their sister, and people who were f***ing had a degree in knowing all about making PPE equipment, and in one case, Matt Hancock's bloody landlord. And now the BBC had had, who would have thought? They didn't know what they were doing apart from everybody. And there's, but then, oh, how you jump. So even Dominic Cummings, if people remember, was caught breaking all the rules by driving to a place called Barnard Castle, hundreds of miles. And he said he was doing it because he wanted to check his eyes were working properly. And so therefore, he did what anyone would do. If you think your eyes aren't working properly, you get all your family, put them in a car and go, let's drive 200 miles. And if we cause a multi-car pile up and kill a load of people, then it's clear my eyes need looking at. And
then you go to the optician.
Then you go to the optician. All of this. But even so, I don't think we were aware of the scale of just how mental. So Boris Johnson, it turns out, at the start of the COVID, said, isn't COVID just nature's way of dealing with the elderly? Rishi Sunak, according to Dominic Cummings, said, shouldn't we just let people die? Whether he did say that or not, I don't know, but Dominic Cummings claims he didn't. He was like, all of them are full of this. None of them. Patrick Vallance, who was the chief advisor at the time, the government said that they didn't have a clue, that Boris Johnson in one cabinet meeting said we should have a full-on lockdown like France, and then a minute later said we should have no lockdown at all and just let it rip. So just like a toddler, let's go to the seaside. Oh, shall we? No, I hate the seaside. Just like all of them, utterly, utterly useless. And the one thing they did know is that having told everybody that they should lock down and under no circumstances go anywhere with anyone else at all, they then immediately went into the upstairs room at Downing Street with about 120 of them and had a Ibiza night where they were all playing drum and bass and shagging each other with pace and wheelbarrow loads of drink and being sick over each other and getting buckets of COVID and spraying each other with it over a garden hose and then saying they didn't do it. And then Boris Johnson going, no, the photo weren't conclusive because maybe I'm not me. Maybe I'm Shirley Bassey. And I just un-fucking believable how they're not all in jail.
My favourite part of it was the kind of the turn of Dominic Cummings to sort of whistleblower and revealing all of these horrible conversations and these horrible things that people had said and these horrible strategies that were tabled without ever mentioning how much of it was like, oh, and that was my idea, by the way.
yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's just one after that. And also the language of them all. They're all sort of calling each other ass. Which shitheads, moronic, stupid, all this sort of thing. Unbelievable. And poor Chris Whitty, who was the scientific bloke who had to stand there every day and say that this is what we feel that the current situation is likely to lead to. And he'd have these slides, and he was a scientist, and he understood it all. And then he would say all that, and that's why we're advising this. And then the government would do exactly the opposite. And go, no. And then they would go, the government would go, we're all through. The slogan was, we are following the science. But they weren't following the science at all. They might as well said, we are following the science. And that's why everyone over the age of 70, if we're going to, actually, we're following that Midsummer film. Everyone over the 70 has to climb up to the top of the garage and jump off into a bath with an electric fire in it because they're too old. And this is nature's way of dealing with the elderly because we're following the science. And Chris Whitty must feel like a surgeon who's about to be halfway through giving someone a heart bypass, and then Boris Johnson comes in and goes, give me that. I think we should pour creosote on his liver and fill his kidneys with pickled onions. And then he just had to do it. And then 3 years later go, I was aware at the time that there was certain concerns about the government's approach with regard to the pickled onions.
I always thought that nature's way of dealing with the elderly was making them inclined to vote Tory, their own natural predator.
Yes. I mean, it's remarkable that they were killing off the very people who put them in power, but I suppose that shows just that, oh, they're ever so good at killing us all, let's vote for them again.
I'll be honest, I mean, the COVID, it's not my thing as a drama. I've tried to follow it, but my main problem, and I have this with a lot of the kind of big TV box sets, is that I find the central character just deeply implausible and unlikable on too many levels. In this case, it's Boris Johnson, who was described as bamboozled by science, which would have been the title of Dances with Wolves if it had been starring Boris Johnson instead of Kevin Costner. He also said this, well, on the subject of suggesting that old people should be allowed to die, he said they've had a good innings, which as a cricket fan, you know, I never like hearing that terminology misused, because that's what he's basically saying is they've had a long innings, and it needs to be sort of means tested in a way, because if you're 75 but you've lived most of your life struggling to get by and are just hoping to have a few years of relative stability to enjoy some of the things in life you're never able to do before, that's not a good innings, so therefore you should qualify for healthcare. But if, say, you're 60, minted, have been on 3 holidays a year for most of your life, play golf twice a week, eat out in fancy restaurants and own a seldom-used antique Victorian sex chair, that is a good innings, and therefore you should be the one jumping off the roof or whatever it was that you were suggesting. Matt Hancock, the health secretary, was described as having a habit of saying things that were not true, which is not ideal as health secretary, given that health is at least partially related to science, in which facts and truth are quite useful, and not harmlessly. I'm not saying sort of harmless things that weren't true, such as, did you know Florence Nightingale once performed a tracheotomy on a leopard cub whilst blindfolded, or you can cure mumps by standing on your head for an hour singing these boots are made for walking, but actually damaging lies that had an impact on the public. But anyway, I think the important thing though is, I mean, we sort of is to learn how we might do things better next time. Are there lessons that we can learn? Now, do bear in mind, this is a difficult thing for us here in Britain, because we've seldom, if ever, had to learn lessons, because we've never got anything wrong through history. That's just how things are when you're British. But, you know, I don't know what lessons you think we should be learning, either of you. What do you think should be the learnings from this this crisis?
I think we should learn to carry on much as we've been doing.
All right, good.
I think we should, whenever the scientists in Italy and France, scientists and governments in Italy and France and China all effectively carry out a way of curbing a new epidemic, we should call them all foreign twats and do the very opposite, and then go, oh shit, everyone in the care home is being wheeled out under a blanket.
And I think another thing we should learn is to be careful what we wish for. Sorry, not wish, vote. And I think a good rule of thumb is, if you wouldn't trust someone to look after one or more of your teddy bear, girlfriend, economy, lunch or democracy, for f*** sake, don't make them prime minister. I think that's probably a pretty sound rule of thumb.
They all know, don't they? All these people who are going, well, I mean, he does seem to be rather someone who didn't pay attention to detail and was rather more concerned with his own well-being and his finances. And just didn't realise he was like that.
Well, to be fair, I mean, it's democracy working for once. He had laid those cards firmly on the table over decades in public life, and he was merely giving the nation what it voted for.
I would say, you know, their mothers could have told you they were like this, except all of their mothers outsourced the work to a nanny. That's why they're all f***ed.
People being sacked and then unsacked news now. And Alice, you have been covering the world of tech gazillionaires for, well, pretty much as long as you've been on this this podcast. Years? When was it? 2017, I think. You're first on. Wow, it's got that. Doesn't time fly? Bring us up to date with the latest exciting news from the crazy world of top-level tech.
I mean, this is such exciting news that if we had just waited a week to see what would happen, would have not have been news at all, because someone got fired and then rehired back into the same position. So if we'd just held fire, we wouldn't have needed all of the op-eds on what happened. Out of the blue, seemingly, on Friday, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman was fired by the board of directors. And then after much scandal and controversy, playing social media and normal media, he staged a counter coup. He mobilized hundreds of employees, including, incredibly enough, the original coup leader. And he won the support of all the investors, including Microsoft, against the company itself, and got rehired in the same position, which has got to be awkward for the people who stabbed him in the back. If anyone is not sure what OpenAI is, it's the parent company of ChatGPT, and it's sort of in the forefront of the tech world at the moment. The problem with AI at the moment is that one of the proposed reasons that he was fired was that he wasn't taking safety seriously enough, that this possible AI could be a threat to humanity, and that he's pushing ahead for commercial gain without considering the potential implications of this world-changing technology. But the real problem with AI is that what we call AI isn't what you would call AI if you were trying to describe what AI is meant to be. So the thing that we used to call AI in sci-fi, we now call AGI, or artificial general intelligence, because what we call AI is not actually AI, it's sort of a sophisticated mashup machine that's being sold as the future of technology and humanity by people whose favorite thing is selling the thing they haven't invented yet. So he's been hailed as a genius mainly for stuff that he hasn't done yet, but says will happen soon. And no one's willing to lose the possibility that he might still do it. So far, I think the market has been very credulous about the claims of these tech bros, because the future seems cool and no one wants to miss investing in the next better mousetrap. But the problem is that the tech industry as a whole does not want to build a better mousetrap. They want to pitch a mousetrap app that they dreamed up while microdosing absinthe in the desert to get VC funding within 6 months and then retire having built nothing, but taking the credit for fundamentally disrupting the mousetrap industry using an AI-enabled crypto blockchain, which you can use to mint unique mouse coins, each coin stably tethered to one individual dead mouse's DNA. And then you ask them what the core service of their app is, and it turns out it's just a tax taxi that you call and then they drive by and throw an angry cat in your window and then you rank the cat by customer service, general fluffiness and mouse-killing ability, but now the app's only being used by Nazis and incels to throw cats through the windows of women they don't like because the developers did not think through any of the possible ways in which their service could be misused. And now cats with low fluffiness ratings are killing themselves because the app's given them a self-esteem problem. And right. That's the tech industry
now. No, I understand it now.
Yeah, I think I both understand it more and less. Thanks. Also, I think, that might be the longest sentence in the history of the Bugle. And I think Mark's put in a few challenges for that over the years. And, it's a hotly contested title, to be honest.
Thank you.
I know it will be all right. I know it will do all of these things in the end, and it'll be both dangerous and amazing and all of that. But at the moment, does it do much AI?
No, it aggregates enormous amounts of data and then spits them back out.
Yeah.
In a sort of a information slurry.
Yeah. So if you tell it a load of stuff and then ask it something, it will tell you one of the things back that you told it. And everyone goes, it's amazing.
Well, I guess so. It takes in all this stuff and then splurges some of it back. So essentially, it's at the baby stage.
Yes.
So you've got to be careful because it'll eventually, when you have teenage AI, it will be.
Yeah,
saying,
you'll ask it. You'll say, "Can you write me a speech, please, for my presentation at the diagnostics technology conference?" And it will go, oh, why the f*** should I?
Let's move on now to rats news. Alice, you are, as we speak, in Australia, and you have been... Well, Australia is in the grip of a plague of rats, that classic trope of humanity that seems to recur throughout history. Are you going to be the Pied Piper that removes the rats from Australia?
Well, I mean, I hope so. These rats are washing up on thousands of rats, both dead and alive, washing up on beaches in Queensland, which is... I'm about to move to a small coastal town in Queensland, so I can only hope that this is going to pass me by. Look... Everyone's horrified at this prospect. We had a mouse plague not so long ago. It was pretty awful. And now it's a mixed mouse and rat plague, and everyone's really horrified. But I think from one perspective, you could see this as a kind of a wildlife racism. Like, because it's rats, it's way more disgusting. But you have to, really rethink this. You know, if it was a plague of cute wallabies who were driving your ducks mad or stripping the wiring out of your car, or thousands of dead koalas washing up on the beach. No, you're right, it's still disgusting. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say a plague of anything is bad news.
Yeah.
But on the bright side, rats in fishing towns can only mean one thing, which is the launch of a charming children's book about pirate rats, which I have an exclusive extract from right here.
Yep.
He skittered here across the deck, he put the hairs up on your neck, he plundered gold and also cheese, the pirate rat was hard to please. One leg of wood, three legs of leg, one eye a hook, one ear a peg. He played upon a pirate flute, a song of stealing pirate loot. The problem is that every time a parrot lands on his shoulder, it carries him off to feed his children, so the lead rat has to keep being replaced by similar-looking rats.
Oh, but like our prime ministers.
The kayfabe on the production process is intense.
I guess the real concern for those of you who've film aficionados is that you could have a rat-nado if there's a obviously Los Angeles was struck by that very serious shark-nado a few years ago. If when you move to Queensland, if adverse weather conditions, you could have a rat-nado, which no one wants to see.
You're right though, the rats get a bad press if it was, because it would be it'd be worse, wouldn't it, if there was a badgers or something, if there was a plague of badgers or giraffes. Oh no. Fucking plague of giraffes. They get in through the bloody, they come out through the skirting.
Yeah, you open what you thought was a harmless box of cereal and they scuttle out on the floor.
Oh yeah. Now they come, one of them's got his neck stuck through the cat flap and now it goes right across the living room. To clamber over it, just to get out into the kitchen.
Other rats news now. Rats in space. Science has been experimenting on rats, as it tends to do, and it has discovered through experimenting on rats that space travel could lead to erectile dysfunction. Now, we have had our quarrels with scientific research on this show at various points over the past 16 and a bit years, but I think this might top it all. That here we are. We have some scientists who had some rats, and presumably their boss said to them, "Right, I'm giving you some rats. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but there we are. They're rats. People find them hard to warm to, so we can experiment on them and get away with it. I'm going to leave you alone for 3 months in the laboratory with these rats, and I want you to do some research to benefit humanity. Off you go." 3 months later, comes back in. "What have you got? Cure for malaria, new drug that means you can live in 50 degree heat with almost no oxygen. That would be useful, at least a fetching new shade of eyeshadow. Yes, boss. We found out that rats can't get rat boners if you blast them with a cosmic ray gun." Great. Well done, guys. Let me just call the f***ing Nobel Committee right now. Rats can't get boners in space. That is the headline story from this news. And I guess it does sort of illustrate a lot about research into space travel, because we all know why this is a concern and why the research is being done into whether or not you can get a boner in space. Because the space race...
Everyone wants to f*** the stars. What?
Well, that's because our space race between our heroic billionaires is basically, fundamentally, a race between the world's richest, most powerful people to be the first human to shtwap an alien. They all want to be the first. Musk, Zuckerberg, Bezos, Oliver, Djokovic, and Barney. They all want to be the first to enjoy astrocarnal conjugalments with whatever extraterrestrial hotsters we encounter in the nether regions of space. That's the only explanation for this research.
And you would think that an erection would be easier to achieve when there was no gravity, wouldn't you? Surely, you're not to have one.
Yep. But yep.
Everything floats, doesn't it?
Yep.
I'm for this. I'm for every kind of achievement that you would attempt to get women with being negatively correlated with penis function. Like, if you're like the moment you make more than like $10 million, I reckon you should be chemically castrated. Like, I feel like every politician who gets a position of power over anyone should immediately have like one third of their balls chopped off. Like, I feel like this should be the penalty for success.
And so obvious, but will Keir Starmer put that in his manifesto?
Well, he just won't commit to anything that might be even slightly controversial. Obviously, you know, there's something sort of, you know, kind of glamorous and exciting about science, and that sense that you are helping stretch the bounds of knowledge and improve the state of humanity. But when you find yourself trying to get a rat to roll over onto its back to see if it's got the horn, you must think, maybe I should have done something else.
Well, they don't tickle it with a little Q-tip. What do they do?
I don't know.
Rat porn.
I don't think even rats would like rat porn, would they?
No, rats only jerk off to gerbil porn. Very controversial piece of gerbil porn doing the rounds in high school during the early 2000s, in which a gerbil put a very small figurine of Richard Gere up its ass.
Yeah.
Family show, Alice. Family show. Of course, it might not be the cosmic rays and the microgravity that stop the rats getting boners. It could be just
and then some gerbils go, "Oh, that's just made up." It's an urban myth. No, I'm with it. I'm on the gerbil news.
Sorry.
Well, I expect to be hearing from both Richard Gere and the gerbils' lawyers at some point in the next. We're going to just quickly look at the Cricket World Cup final that happened last weekend, in which India won the runners-up prize in the two-team final against Australia. And that was not how it was supposed to end. What was it, 6 or 7 weeks of cricket leading to the final in the Narendra Modi Stadium, the stadium in Ahmedabad that was named after Narendra Modi by Narendra Modi the day before it opened. And it was all set to be one of the greatest moments of sporting propaganda. But India, unfortunately for Narendra Modi, lost. I mean, they are a sensationally good cricket team. They won 10 in a row to reach the final, 9 in the group stage, then the semi-final. You don't need to be a professional cricket statistician to know that they were one of the top three most statistically dominant teams in a World Cup group stage ever in men's World Cup cricket. You don't need to be a professional cricket statistician because I am one and I've just told you that. But it did seem that India winning in front of their prime minister in a stadium their prime minister had named after their prime minister, it seemed that was written in the stars. But unfortunately, there are a of a lot of stars, and if you look hard enough with the right telescope in the right place, you can find anything written in the stars, including the words "f-ing typical Australia." They always come good when it matters, and that's that's what happened in this case. Mark, it was I mean, it did seem all the way through that India were too good for everyone, but such is sport.
Yeah, well, you said, well, as far as only one game, and of course, a similar thing happened when England were in the World Cup final at badminton that was played at the Liz Truss Stadium that she named after herself, and it just seemed inevitable that England's badminton supremos would come through, but they didn't. And then not only that, but she actually bankrupted the leisure centre.
It feels like the real story here that a lot of people have been focusing on is the bad sportsmanship, not of the players, but of the fans for not sticking it through to watch their team get thoroughly trounced. And if you really were in it for the love of the game, then you would have stuck around and seen your defeat and, you know, given due credit to the honourable winners. Yeah. But it feels like, the fans don't know how to go about their business anymore.
Well, I mean, that is something certainly in England traditionally, that you would applaud the opposition, if only just to keep warm, because for a start, certainly when I was growing up, there was basically nothing to applaud England for. So you had to applaud the opposition, otherwise you would just slowly freeze to death under a tarpaulin.
Just the sort of the comical sort of acceptance of defeat. I watched England lose to Iceland in the Euro Championships 7 or 8 years ago on a beach in Brighton, in front of a big screen. There must be about 3,000-4,000 people there. And by the end of it all, I think it's fair to say most people found it hilarious. I think other countries, that's the one thing other countries could learn from the English. By the end, everyone was sort of thinking, oh, I hope we don't equalise now because this is funny.
Right, that brings us to the end of this week's Bugle. Alice, anything to plug apart, of course, from the Gargle, where this week you can hear more about the OpenAI hirings and firings.
Yes, the Gargle, a sister podcast to the Bugle, is still available every week with me. And unbound.com, if you write in Alice Fraser, you can pre-order the Dancy Lagarde reader, which I have finished writing.
Congratulations.
So now it's up to them as to when it will end up in your hot little hands, but it's available for pre-order at unbound.com and type in Alice Fraser.
All right. Exciting.
Mark?
Well, you can come and see me having chemotherapy every Monday for the next 6 weeks. And tickets will be going on sale soon if you go to www.marksteel.chemo.cancer.uk. And I think there's still some left for the second week. And then we're taking it on tour later in the year, if that works. I'll be doing Shrewsbury, Doncaster, going to hospitals all over Britain, and also I'll have support some places, you know, for people who haven't been diagnosed yet, you know, just starting out, open spot cancer people. It's always good to give them a chance. This is all predicated on the fact that this goes all right. Then Mark Steel's in Town, my series will be on again at some point when I'm able to do them. But I have been to Margate already this week, and I'm looking around there, and then I'm going to go to Stoke soon. I don't know what the other ones will be yet.
And your podcast?
Oh, yes. What the f*** is going on?
Do listen to that. as well.
Oh, also, I do a weekly writers' meeting on my Patreon, which you can currently get for $1 a month. Actually, I do two weekly writers' meetings that you can currently get for $1 a month because I don't know how business works. Patreon.com/AliceFraser. Two hourly weekly writers' meetings for $1 a month.
That's half $1 a meeting.
I'm going to have a baby.
Don't forget to book your tickets for the Bugle live tour in March. Numerous venues around the UK, including Glasgow, Norwich, Birmingham, Salford / Manchester. There's a London date in June and some other dates that I can't remember offhand. So I'm going to just leave that mysteriously in the air for you to find out for yourselves. Tickets available via thebuglepodcast.com or elsewhere on the internet. To join the Bugle voluntary subscription scheme and to make a one-off or recurring contribution to help keep this show free, flourishing and independent, go to thebuglepodcast.com. Premium level subscribers get exclusive access to the monthly Ask Andy show, where I answer your questions, and we are shortly going to be recording a Bugle vinyl record for our premium voluntary subscribers as well. So we are embracing the future of technology. We'll be back next week with Stuart Lee and Felicity Ward. Until then, goodbye.